Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast, a conversation where good thoughts help renew the mind with the Word of God. You're here with Tim, Charlie, Andy, and Josh. Welcome to the conversation.
Ugh.
Welcome to the Thinklings Podcast.
Good morning.
I think I caught you just saying you about your...
I just took a sip.
Yeah. So, good morning.
Boker Tov.
Good morning.
Howdy, y'all.
Not again.
I think I do that every time. I just had to do it one more.
So, we have a special round of what are we drinking today?
Ooh, yes.
Okay, so guess the region. This is special. It's not, I don't think it
went. I think it's a medium.
Okay, I think it's a medium. Okay.
All right. And then I think it has some kind of flavoring in it, which kind of makes it difficult to guess the region.
Okay. So.
Region, I'm going to go earth.
Earth.
And by earth, I mean dirt.
It's on dirt. The planet. You're horrendous.
It's got a very earthy flavor.
Okay.
We were corrected in that we have our hemispheres incorrect as far as it's Central America. Most of it's in the Northern Hemisphere.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
So we
that's
need right. to actually get a map.
You know, Ecuador is south of Central America and the equator runs through
Ecuador.
Through Ecuador.
Ecuador.
Yeah. And so all of those countries north of Ecuador are.
Geography is challenging.
You know what that reminded me of is when I was in Greek all that many moons ago, and my Greek professor said, you know how you remember the word thronos? That means throne. Maybe the word thronos sounds like its definition for throne. I've never forgot that word.
I do that every year still, and the students still eye roll me. Okay.
I should say, I shouldn't be giving geography lessons. I couldn't even pronounce Lethoso the other week.
That was a great comment.
You did better than any of us could have done. Let's be honest.
Okay, so no guesses on the region.
I'm going to just say it's
Brazil.
I was thinking Brazil too. I'll go Guatemalan.
Okay, Guatemalan.
So Guatemalan medium, and it's got some kind of flavoring in it. I'm trying to guess the flavoring, but
caramel.
I was thinking caramel too.
But you didn't say caramel earlier. What'd you say?
I said burnt caramel.
Oh, you're horrendous.
Earthy burnt caramel from somewhere on earth.
Okay.
It's my vote.
Josh, you want to guess?
Cumberland Punch.
Explain that reference for those who are not Southern.
So I lived in Nashville before relocating to Iowa, and the Cumberland River runs through Nashville. And so if you would drink a beverage that left something to be desired, Cumberland Punch.
Okay.
I don't have a flavoring to guess other than caramel. It seems like caramel to
me. Okay. So I think it's roasty. I don't think it's great. It is. I think it's like taste medium too. But did you perhaps feel more intellectual? Like you were going to live the intellectual life.
Oh, yes, I did.
Did you feel like you wanted to talk about divine simplicity all the time, like Jiraiya Shank?
No.
No,
well, definitely
I don't
not
think
that
ever happens.
You are drinking Catholic Coffee's St. Thomas Aquinas roast.
Oh, that's awesome. Oh.
So Luke Shepherd he went on a trip to somewhere, South Carolina, and he's at some little gift shop and they had all these Catholic coffees. And so he's like,
awesome.
Dude, check this out. I'm like, oh my word.
I see that when you're done.
So this is a Peruvian blend that starts bright with lemongrass flavor and finishes with notes of roasted honey, Charlie.
Oh, burnt caramel.
Burnt caramel, roasted honey. So, I'm just going to read the back. So, the subtitle is Catholic Coffee, Grounded in Faith. At Catholic Coffee, we believe in truth, beauty, and goodness, and coffee. All of our heavenly roasts are crafted to lift your spirits and bring a bit of the divine into your home. So, part of me was like a little bit weird, like I'm supporting the Catholic Coffee. But it was funny. So, I picked Thomas Aquinas because he's the most, I didn't want, you could pick the Pope, you could pick Mary. It's like all these things.
That is awesome.
So, Luke Shepherd texted me, I'm like, can you please bring me a bag back? So, shout out to Luke Shepherd. We are having a great time tasting this not super awesome coffee.
You can
it
taste.
Is a medium roast, though. Look at that right in the middle, Tim. Medium with a flavor. So, I feel like, okay, here you go. So
you can taste the lack of grace.
You can,
oh, wow. That's horrendous.
I will say I really feel like I had to work to like this coffee.
You guys are horrendous.
But seriously, Luke Shepherd, that was fantastic. Well done. I give you a 10 out of 10 on your submission, even though the coffee itself is probably like a 1. And Zach, yours was good, but you've fallen behind your brothers a little bit, just a little bit. So
it is certainly a Lenten brew.
Oh, that's
beautiful.
Yeah, you're giving something up but the why I said the Sertiange thing is because Sertiange, like the intellectual life, he was studying Thomas Aquinas.
That
was the, okay, you all got it.
And so
no, I did not get that.
Moving on. Listener interaction. We want to give a shout out to Matt Tolosa. We know he listens regularly and just want him to know that we're praying for him. And,
yes.
Yeah. So
we love you, brother.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Praying for you.
Going through a little difficult time, and but we're thankful for Matt and his blessing to us over the mm-hmm. years here.
Yes.
And in the rest of this episode, we're going to do books and business here. Then the main content is Tim talking about worship or raising hands in worship. And so you can enjoy that a little bit later on. But of course, before we do that.
Books and business.
Let's talk about some books, and Tim gets to go first.
So Dr. Paul and I just came back from Cedarville, Ohio, and we presented our papers. He did something on religious liberty and a couple of people I didn't know, Nussbaum and somebody else. I presented on the Dechristologizing the Song of Songs. So I've been reading a lot of articles, and now I'm getting ready for my Ecclesiastes module, which takes place in a couple of weeks. The article that I'm going to just talk about, because, you know, if you're reading a whole pile of articles, I'm like, how do I do this? The author is Magne Saebo, S-A-E-B-O. It's that weird A-E letter that's kind of disappeared. Is it Saebo? Is that how you say it? And the O has like a line through it, so I'm not sure even how to say this person's name. The article's title is On the Canonicity of the Song of Songs. This is the article. The book is Text, Temples, and Traditions, a tribute to Menahem Haran. And at the end of the article, he has a few short comments about the word that I was studying, Shalhevetia. Shalhevetia, which is the flame of the Lord word from Song 8:6. And so that's my article. He talks about the canonicity of the Song of Songs.
Tim, did you just like have any flipping over experiences for your
amazing.
Weekend?
Amazing, like exactly.
So what's the word for flame?
Shalhevet, yeah. Shalhevet.
Okay.
So the regular word for in Hebrew for fire is ash.
Okay.
Okay. So but you have other words, reshef, which is a flame, and then shalhevet or shalheva, and that would be another word for flame. It's like three different words.
Let me try this again. So, Tim, on the way home, did anything weird happen to you involving rolling over things?
I think he wants me to tell a story.
Well, if you don't tell, then it's going to be a really weird comment that I just made for no reason.
What does it have to do with the book?
We were driving home.
Just okay, wait.
Oh, from Cedarville.
From Cedarville. And I'm on my computer. So it's Dr. Paul and myself. I'm just on my computer, pounding through. All of a sudden, Dr. Paul hits the brakes and he's like, whoa. And I look up and there's this semi skidding down the road on its side.
Oh,
and it's completely blocked.
Andy's showing me a picture of this right now.
And this semi just, he messed up whatever, and the thing flipped on its side and skidded down the interstate and came to a stop right in front of us. Well, not right in front of us. We were quite a ways behind. It really wasn't that dangerous, but we got out, and because we were like the first ones there. And this other trucker on the other side of the road came over and he started peeling it out. How you doing, brother? You know, and so he, like, they're trying to get him out of the car. And I pulled the windshield off of the thing and helped the guy get out. And a nurse happened to be there. And I prayed for the guy. And then the nurse bandaged him up. And we sat in our car for 2 hours while the wreckers came to pull the semi off of the interstate. And Dr. Paul's in the driver's seat reading a book. And I'm on my computer reading articles on Ecclesiastes getting ready for my module.
So
a regular day in the neighborhood.
I just thought that had to be included. Like,
yes.
Nothing like another day in the office where you're writing stuff and, oh, let me go take a guy out of his... Okay, I'm back.
So where I thought that was going to go was like Dr. Paul, like, hit and killed an animal. That's what, that's where I wanted that to go. But
oh,
that's
sorry,
better.
Charlie.
That's better.
It's like,
books and business.
Books and business.
Have fun following that, Josh.
I'll do my best. The novel that I'm discussing this week is My Antonia by Willa Cather, so American 20th century author. This particular novel was published first in 1918, and then she published it again in 1926. And the interesting thing about those two publications is that the introduction, which is actually part of the book, is quite different from the 1926 version from the 1918 version. And so you want to be aware of that because it does kind of frame the story that takes place and how you think of Jim Burden. And so the story is about Jim Burden, a young man at age 10. His parents die. He leaves Virginia, goes to live with his grandparents in Nebraska. So the setting of the story is the prairie, Nebraska, It's 1880 or so. And so there's lots of people from all over the world that are settling there. And as he's traveling from Virginia to Nebraska, he sees a Bohemian family and they're going to settle close by. And so there's a girl in that family, Antonia, and she's 14. And so the story is, you know, it opens with this introduction, is an unnamed narrator. And this narrator and Jim Burden now live in New York, and they meet each other on a train, and they both grew up in this area in Nebraska. And so they begin talking, and their conversations continually go back to this young girl, Antonia, that occupies their memories. And in the 1918 introduction, as they're talking about it, there's kind of like this wager. Well, why don't you write what you remember about Antonia, and I'll write what I know about Antonia, and then we'll compare stories. Okay. But in the 1926, it's far different. Jim has been thinking about Antonia for years and years. As a child, he loved her in some way. And so he's been, as an adult, he's been thinking about her and writing about her on these long train trips from New York back into the you know, Western United States. He now, as a man, as an adult, is a lawyer for a powerful railway company. And so he's made, quote unquote, a success of himself, but he's in a very unhappy marriage, which is just alluded to in the introduction. That's the only bit you get of it. So after the introduction, then what you're reading is Jim's memories about Antonia for the entire, you know, novel and his growing up with this girl. And he fills in on some of the other characters there as well. But I want to read a couple of passages here. This is one of the final chapters, the final book. So it's five books. It's a short novel, but it's separated into five books. And the fifth book is called Cusack's Boys. And this is when Jim goes back 20 years later to meet Antonia. And she has a bunch of strapping young boys, and she's living there on the prairie. And so this is his seeing her again. And I just want to read two passages, and then I'll have a couple of quick thoughts about them. So he shows up where she lives, and one of Antonia's daughters welcomes him in. Antonia is not there at the moment. "Won't you come in? Mother will be home in a minute." Before I could sit down in the chair she offered me, the miracle happened. One of those quiet moments that clutch the heart and take more courage than the noisy, excited passages in life. Antonia came in and stood before me. A stalwart, brown woman, flat-chested, her curly brown hair a little grizzled. It was a shock, of course. It always is, to meet people after long years, especially if they have lived as much and as hard as this woman had. We stood looking at each other. The eyes that peered anxiously at me were simply Antonia's eyes. I had seen no others like them since I looked into them last, though I had looked at so many thousands of human faces. As I confronted her, the changes grew less apparent to me, her identity stronger. She was there, in the full vigor of her personality, battered but not diminished, looking at me, speaking to me in the husky, breathy voice I remembered so well. And then the final passage. So he experiences time with Antonia and her husband and her children, and at night, he goes with the boys to sleep in the barn, and he's lying there, and he's thinking about this encounter and this day that he's had with Antonia and her family. And this is his reflection. "I lay awake for a long while until the slow, moving moon passed my window on its way up the heavens. I was thinking about Antonia and her children, about Anna's solicitude for her, Ambrosia's grave affection, Leo's jealous animal little love. That moment when they all came tumbling out of the cave into the light was a sight any man might have come far to see. Antonia had always been one to leave images in the mind that did not fade, that grew stronger with time. In my memory, there was a succession of such pictures fixed there, like the old woodcuts of one's first primer. Antonia kicking her bare legs against the sides of my pony when we came home in triumph with our snake. Antonia in her black shawl and fur cap as she stood by her father's grave in the snowstorm. Antonia coming in with her work team along the evening skyline. She lent herself to immemorial human attitudes which we recognize by instinct as universal and true. I had not been mistaken. She was a battered woman now, not a lovely girl. But she still had that something which fires the imagination, could still stop one's breath for a moment by a look or gesture that somehow revealed the meaning in common things. She had only to stand in the orchard, to put her hand on a little crab tree and look up at the apples, to make you feel the goodness of planting and tending and harvesting at last. All the strong things of her heart came out in her body that had been so tireless in serving generous emotions. It was no wonder that her sons stood tall and straight. She was a rich mine of life, like the founders of the early races. And one thing I love about this novel is you have Jim, and he, as a young man, just felt destined for larger things. And so he goes to the University of Nebraska, meets a guy who teaches classics, and he studies the classics. And then that professor moves to Harvard and takes Jim with him. So Jim goes east, is educated in the classics at Harvard, becomes a lawyer, and is just, you know, living a quote unquote successful life as a lawyer for a railway, but has a marriage that is unsatisfying. No intimacy between him, his wife and himself in terms of just kind of a close relationship. And he comes back and he sees Antonia, and she's lived a life of, there's been some suffering. Her father commits suicide when she's a young girl. She is deceived by a young man who takes her away, and she gets pregnant, but he then leaves and doesn't marry her. So she comes back with this child, but she's not ashamed of that child. She loves that child, raises that child. She gets married to a man from Bohemia and raises this family of boys. And Jim comes back and he looks at her, and she is just so satisfied in the life that she's living. Just faithfulness in the little things, in the simple things of life, being a mother, being industrious, raising boys and girls who so clearly and evidently love their mom. When you read about these kids and the way they interact with their mom, it's one of the most beautiful passages in American literature. It's just so beautiful. And so I think as I teach this novel, one of the things that the novel is asking us is to think about what is success. And Jim is looking back, and he's looking at Antonia, and he's thinking, you know, this is success, is being content and satisfied to do the little things day in and day out well, to be a loving wife, a loving mother who's industrious. It's just beautiful, beautiful.
Two things. One, Ecclesiastes, boom.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Just to be content with and enjoy your little the slice. Little things.
Yep.
Was there a slight little homage there to Plato's cave? Like, she's the cave and the kids spill out into the light.
It's possible that something like that is there. What he's really describing there is the way that these settlers lived on the prairie is they would have, most of them were sod structures, and they would actually dig down into the ground. So Jim's first house with his grandparents, they were one of the few that had a wooden structure, but the kitchen was underground in a cave. Excuse me. And so he might be referring to that, but there is, well, as a classicist, as he's looking at that, perhaps there is some allusion.
Before you'd shared about his classical reading and training, you read that and I was like, oh, that's an interesting way to describe it. But I didn't have the backdrop of like a literal cave. But then like, here's the woman who is like the philosophical answer to life. And then the kids pour out of the cave into her light. And that I was like, oh, that feels like Plato to me.
Yeah.
But
that's a very good point.
I could just be reading into it. But
well, as a classicist, he would maybe, I mean, he's choosing his words carefully. So,
all right, I'm going to review and rank a book that I just finished. It's a very small book called The Treasure Principle by Randy Alcorn. It's a book about finances and money and using them for the glory of God. He is going to help. He takes the principle of laying up treasures in heaven as the main point of the book. And so he talks a lot about, there's a lot of reasoning with you about what if you had all this treasure now, but what if you could send it on ahead to heaven and then you could have it then? And So he addresses all the issues. So sometimes when people talk about trying to lay up treasures and do all that, people will say, well, that's just selfishness. And so he addresses selfishness. He says, no, but God promises this. He talks about the fact that we're stewards and we're just stewarding God's money. And so he said, there's a couple of quotes where, what if, you gave someone something to steward for you, and then they just took it home and played with it. And the intent was to give it to them to use for your business. It's very simple stuff. It's very, very good stuff. One thing that would be worth sharing is part of his story. I didn't know this. This is really fascinating. So he's a pastor and has been for years. And in 1990, he was on the board of a crisis pregnancy center where you could go if you got pregnant, and they would try to dissuade you from having an abortion and give you support and bringing the kid into the world and then caring for it. And part of what he did is he brought in a pregnant teen into his home and they cared for her. And they decided that, you know what, we need to start participating in peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience at abortion clinics. And this is the 90s. And so they would get outside and picket. He said, we simply stood in front of the doors to advocate on behalf of unborn children scheduled to die. For this, I was arrested and sent to jail. An abortion clinic won a court judgment against a group of us. I told the judge that I would pay anything I owed, but I couldn't hand over money to people who would use it to kill babies. Please understand, I've never failed to pay any other debts, but I would not voluntarily pay money to a business that exists to kill children. I chose to live with the legal consequences for refusing to do so. Then I discovered that my church would be forced to surrender 1/4 of my wages each month to an abortion clinic. The church would have to either pay the abortion clinic or defy the court order. So what do you do as a pastor if you've not broken any laws and it's totally a wicked court thing? So to prevent this, he resigned. He'd already gotten rid of all his book royalties. And so the rest of his life is him living on minimum wage payments from his church, not taking anything extra. They had a house, and so he just was content with his house. He was content with his cars. And then every book that he wrote, he made the royalties go to some sort of a ministry. So he's given away, I don't know how much money he's given away. It's been a ton, but he walks the walk about you can live without all the things. You don't need all the things. And probably maybe the good part of this is he starts off with that parable of the guy who finds the hidden treasure in the field, and then he buries it and he goes and sells everything. And so he's just making an appeal to Christians to not think only about this earth, but to think about what's coming next. He answers all kinds of practical questions. So one that jumps out at me is, well, shouldn't I keep some money back for my kids? Like, shouldn't I give them a big inheritance? And he says, we're not going to do that with our kids. He says, I think a reasonable gift, if you can do it, to help them along, and like sentimental trinkets or things are fine. He says, but he doesn't know anyone who's dropped off like $10 million for their kids and it's been a good thing. He says, also, it's not my money to give to my kids. My job is to steward that money for the glory of God. And so he talks about investments in Christian ministries and missions and whatnot. So it's a really good book. It was very challenging. One last thing he said is, well, what if you don't have any money? Does this book not apply to you? And he just does a little study and points out that most people in the early church were dirt poor. And the people who were praised the most were people who didn't have a lot of money and gave it. He thinks about the Macedonian church. So anyways, this is a really good book. I'm going to rank it a 7. And I've had to go back to our goodness scale to review some things. So let me just defend my ranking, since some of you have a poor opinion of this. Our goodness scale, a number 1 is a not bad ranking. A number 2 through 4 is an enjoyable read. A 5 through 7 is a recommendation. And an 8 through 10 is a strong recommendation. I think I can recommend this, and I think it's really good. I don't think you have to read it, but I think it's a really good book. Now, as a footnote, I probably need to go back and lower the Nightingale trilogy. It was a bit high. Tim was like,
what did you give that one?
I gave the third one an 8.8. And I realized, looking at this, I don't think everyone needs to buy it, but I'd recommend it. So I think those are more in the 5-6 range, but I'm not going to go back and I feel like I can't go back and change it.
Is the Nightingale trilogy the next book that we all read together?
No.
Okay, good.
No. So anyways, but I just think, listener, this is a good book. It's also super short. It's not long.
Very slowly eliminating the possibilities for that.
Yep, I know. I feel it.
My book, really quick, Real Life Discipleship And then the subheading, building churches that make disciples. I'm sure I've talked about this before. The reason I have it today is because it's one of the books my students are reading. We're going to discuss it in class. And it was given to me. I won't name where it was given or who it was given by. It is a good book. But yeah, it's just, it has some nice thoughts in it about discipleship. But I don't know if you guys, Tim, you probably find yourself doing this as you're studying like Ecclesiastes or Song of Songs commentaries. It's really easy to read what you want to be there into someone's book when it's not actually there. So like someone could write a phrase and I could read my meaning into it and be like, oh, that's really good. But to legitimately try to understand the position they're coming from and the philosophy behind the practice they're advocating, that's so much more difficult to do when you read. And this book is a challenge that way because it sounds really good. But then if you really start to try to put the building blocks together, there might be some cracks in that foundation. So it's like, why are they saying these things? So it's a challenging read, I think, in that sense. You can't wholly accept it, but you can't wholly reject it. You have to think through it.
I think I have the opposite problem. Because I'm reading
something. Just because you're so unique, right?
No listener is surprised at this. Go for it, Tim.
I'm like reading through a book or whatever, and I'm like hoping that they say it incorrectly, so then I can use them as an illustration.
Cannon fodder.
I don't know. That was my weekend and last week because I was looking for, you know, I was just like, look at what people are doing here in the decristallizing the Song of Songs paper. Yep. So anyway.
Who's the author?
Jim Putnam is his name. And I don't really...
Did you talk about that like maybe a couple years ago?
Probably.
It vaguely looks familiar, but I can't remember.
Probably
why,
2 years ago.
Okay.
When the last time I taught this discipleship
class.
That
makes sense. Okay. That makes sense.
Because they're on rotation every other year.
And your book had some interesting things to say, Andy, and I'm not sure I agree with all of that, particularly because it's not very Old Testament-ish. With,
yeah, I knew he was going to say this. I knew it.
So anyway.
Memoria?
No, the inheritance.
The inheritance.
Oh, so I had that thought book. Too. Okay. So he makes a distinction, but it's a short book, so he might have to, but I do think he makes a distinction that like, giving your kids enough money to pay for their house or something or do that. Right. I think he's okay with that. I think what he's thinking is his book royalties are
gone.
If you took all of them, he would be super rich. And he's thinking, do I give that to my kids? Mm-hmm. And he wants them to grow and work and all that. But I agree. That might be a weak point. I would say don't dismiss the book just for that. But yeah, that might be something to consider because there's all the commands about leaving your children an inheritance.
Yeah, it's just like helping them succeed in life and stuff. So,
And he would be on that page, but I don't know. But I'd have to go back and read the details.
Yeah.
Hey, you can have riches kept to somebody's pain. Ecclesiastes 5. Whether you have one kid or you have 100, you get hold back and it hurts you.
That's it.
Yeah. Anyway,
Ecclesiastes you want to give 6.
A really quick... summary of what's coming.
So in this episode, we just talk about physical expressions of worship. So the one that kind of precipitated it was raising hands. And so where do we see like this raising hands idea in the Bible? So it's kind of like a biblical theology of raising hands. I would encourage you as you listen to this episode, if it's like, I don't really think this is sufficient or there's something missing here, I want to do a second part to this episode. So email in your questions or scripture passages like you didn't deal with this or that. And we'd love to hear that. Even after we finished recording, it's like, what's the relationship between psalms and songs and prayers? Okay, so we didn't really answer that question. Plus, there's the regulative principle for worship, which I think would be something else to consider. So give it a good listen and write us your feedback. We'd love to hear that. Let's have a conversation about raising hands. You guys are horrendous. They all just raise their hands. Like, that was not planned. Okay, so as we go through this.
You think it wasn't planned.
I raised both of my hands They only raised one of their
hands. Was it the touchdown or was it the...
I did touchdown.
You did touchdown.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So when off air, they were telling me about... I ran across this...
Pictograph,
which they said was a meme, which I wasn't sure if it was actually a meme because it had a lot of information, which I guess is riffing off of Tim Hawkins, yes. Some comedy thing. So anyway, it was a funny story. So let's talk about raising hands. And with this conversation, it's kind of like these physical gestures in worship. What are these physical gestures and how should we think through them? I was sitting in the bookstore and a few students came walking by and we had a conversation about music. And this episode may end up being the beginning of a few episodes. We'll see. But those students, they kind of asked me, hey, Dr. Little, what music do you listen to? And I just kind of looked at them and I'm like, I don't listen to any music.
Amish Paradise.
There we go.
Zoe Girl.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. There you go. Yeah. We're just joking.
Who was the Zoe Girl? Because I had her
Alyssa
book.
Childers.
That's it. Yeah. Alyssa Childers, right. Yeah. Okay, so... anyway, that then precipitated a conversation about why I don't listen to music. And I pulled up Roger Scruton, and he has a YouTube. Somebody posted a talk that he did on Pop Goes the Music, The Tyranny of Pop Music. And I found it helpful and I reference it and encourage people to listen to it. Even if they disagree with him, I think they would benefit from it. So you can go to YouTube and pull up Roger Scruton, The Tyranny of Pop Music. And he provides, I think, some good reasons why you shouldn't be listening to music all the time. So that happened. And I was already planning on doing this raising hands thing. And then the one student was like, why is it that you don't? I haven't heard this before. Why haven't you talked about it on the podcast? And I'm like, well, maybe we will. We'll see. So anyway, here we go. We're going to talk about physical gestures in worship. So when we do a study of worship, typically, what would you do? If you're going to do a biblical theology of worship, what would you do, Andy?
Study, like look at the words for worship in the Bible?
Look at the words for worship. So let's start there. So Carter, did you do a search for worship?
I went to ESV.
Yeah.
And I just typed keyword worship.
Okay. What were some things that popped up?
So, am I just looking Old Testament here?
I think I wanted you to do Old Testament. Andy's going to do New.
So Genesis 22, Abraham said to his young men, stay here with the donkey and I and the boy will go over there and worship.
There we go.
So okay, when he's offering his son.
Yep.
Then Exodus, there's some,
give me another illustration of one. Just, rattle something off.
Exodus 34:14, for you shall worship no other God, for the Lord whose name is jealous is a jealous God.
Exactly. Okay. And as you have it up there, it might be interesting to see what Hebrew word is used in that reference to worship.
The Exodus 34 is Shachah.
Uh-huh.
And that's also the one in Genesis 22.
Uh-huh.
Just doing kind of a quick glance. It looks like all of my keys here are to that word, shacha.
That word. Is it shacha or chava?
Let me look. It's a sheen, shacha.
Okay.
And then there's a couple other ones that are chava.
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 Uh-huh.
That would be like Deuteronomy 30 has chava, a different word.
What's that word? What does it say? Read it.
But if your heart turns away and you will not hear, but are drawn away to worship other gods and serve them.
Ah, okay.
And so, and then it looks like, then there's the word for fear, yara, mm-hmm. That's translated worship and this one's Joshua. So your children might make our children cease to worship. And that's the fear word.
Yeah. Right? Okay. So what we've got here is the beginning of a study of worship. And you can see there's a few different Hebrew words. There's another one, kara, that's also used to worship. And we want to think through, okay, what's going on then contextually in each of these scripture passages when it comes to worship? All right. So we're going to come back to that. Now, what do we see in the New Testament?
You have three primary Greek words that you're going to use. And the first one is proskuneo, which means to fall down in front of the object of worship or the mm-hmm. deity. And as I'm going through the Gospels, That's the main word. So when Satan says, if you'll just worship me, it's like the bow down to me.
Right.
People are around Jesus. They're bowing down to him. There is one usage of another word, sabo. And sabo means to express in gestures, rites, or ceremonies one's allegiance or devotion.
Okay, so that would be more than bowing down. It's like a lot of stuff.
Yes, and that one is only used in, well, the one, I'm going very quickly here, but the main use I found is in Mark 7:7, Jesus quotes Isaiah 29:13. And Isaiah 29:13 says, and the Lord said, because these people draw near with their mouth and honor me with their lips, while their hearts are far from me, and their fear of my commandment is taught by them. And so when Jesus quotes, he says, in vain do they worship me, teaching his doctrine the commandments of men. Maybe that's not that right quote. That might have been a different.
That's Isaiah 29:13.
Okay, that's what it is. But when you get to the epistles, and so when Paul is speaking a lot and saying you should worship, it's the word... oops, sorry, I'm missing. It's latruo.
Latruo from Romans 12:1.
Yep, and latruo means to serve in homage to the deity or in honor of the deity. So, from when he tells us to we should live this way, and that's our spiritual worship. The point is, like, how we live is actually worship.
Yeah,
it's not bowing down. It's not doing these right. It's like how we live our lives.
Okay.
So those are the three terms I found in my very quick brief search. There's probably more, but that's
okay.
It.
What did you have?
Just since you were my Aramaic professor.
Oh, you looked
not
it up.
To be forgotten. There are Aramaic words for worship in Daniel, Sagid, you know, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you shall fall down and worship Sagid.
Okay.
The golden image. So right. not to be forgotten amongst the Hebrew and the Greek is the Aramaic.
Do you got Grok?
I do.
So here we go. We got Grok going to give us a definition.
For our worship. Listeners, what
so
is Grok,
I don't know
Tim?
What this is.
Well, I, so
Grok is Twitter's AI.
Twitter's AI.
It's not Elon Musk AI.
Not an ancient Near Eastern language.
It's AI Musk.
and I didn't specifically ask it about worship. I asked it about raising hands.
Oh, so okay, do you go still, ahead.
The question I asked Grok was, should I raise my hands to worship God? And the response is, whether you raise your hands to worship God is a personal choice, often shaped by your beliefs, comfort, and the traditions of your faith community. Some people find it a natural expression of praise, surrender, or connection, rooted in biblical examples like Psalm 63:4, I will bless you as long as I live, in your name I will lift up my hands, or 1 Timothy 2:8. Others prefer quieter, inward forms of worship and don't feel the need. There's no universal rule. Do what feels authentic to you and aligns with your relationship with God.
Oh, I love it. Okay, so there are two scripture passages that
were
referenced.
Did Grok just tell us to listen to our heart?
Yes.
Oh, I think so. Come on, Elon.
So Psalm 63 and 1 Timothy 2. So those are two texts that we're going to want to look at as we work through this material. All right, so as we've kind of begun our study, if we're thinking through physical gestures in worship, what would be the physical gesture in worship that these passages have talked about?
It seems like bowing down.
Okay, and that's what I want
to
see.
I think he noticed that in
Daniel.
In the Gospels, and in Revelation, I should say, where God's like right there. Right. It's the bowing.
And what does proskuneo mean?
To prostrate yourself,
is
like to bow down in front of.
Yeah. That's what proskuneo actually means, is to prostrate yourself in worship, i.e. to bow down. And as far as the Hebrew is concerned, the normal word for worship, which is often translated as worship, literally means to bow down. So in Genesis 19:1, now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting at the gate of Sodom. When Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground. That's our word. He bowed his face down to the ground. He paid homage to them. Okay? In Exodus 24:1, now he said to Moses, come up to the Lord, you and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and 70 of the elders of Israel, and worship from afar. That's how the ES, or I think I'm using NKJV and everything here, but worship from afar. All right. But what is the word and what is the idea? The idea is to bow down. We see this expressly stated. If you continue to work through it, the two words are used one right after the other. One classic illustration that I didn't even have in my list was Daniel. Okay. It has it right there. Fall down. All right. And then the word for worship and worship. So you'll see these correlations. One of them would be Psalm 22. In Psalm 22, all the ends of the world shall remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations shall worship before you. And then in verse 29, all the prosperous of the earth shall eat and worship. All those who go down to the dust shall bow before him. Okay, so worship and bow are parallel. And the word for bow there in Psalm 22:29 is not the chava word. It's the kara word, to bow down before him. So if we were going to talk about, you know what, I want to have authentic worship, and I'm going to start studying authentic worship, and I want to use or employ physical gestures in my worship, what would be the natural gesture that we should talk about? Okay?
Bowing down.
Bowing down.
At least if you were going to say, I want to follow what the Bible's example is,
right,
I'd say bowing down.
Right. So that's what I wanted us to see. At the outset, this is a pretty universally agreed upon observation. And that's why Daniel Block, even in his book, he's like, well, why are they bowing down? What would be the motivation to bowing down? Okay, so what would be the heart inclination that would lead somebody to bow down? All right, maybe they're not going to practice the bowing down, or maybe if we're going to have genuine worship, maybe people aren't going to be bowing down, literally, but they should probably be bowing down in their hearts. What does that look like?
Humility?
Yes.
Like,
okay, because
like getting low to the ground.
The Lord is.
Yeah.
All right. He is the one that's high and that's lifted up. You're not the one that's high and lifted up. It's a matter of humility, placing yourself lower than the deity. And in our case, of course, it would be the Lord God. How are we doing? Okay. All right. So then before I go there, I do want to talk about the New Testament just briefly. Because you do have the same thing. When some people say, well, it's different in the New Testament. Well, you brought up Matthew 4 already with Jesus and Satan, all right? And the terminology there, if you will fall down and worship me, all right? So the idea is this bowing down. It's right there in the text. And then Jesus responds, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only you will serve. Now, Jesus then connects worship to service. Oh, so what is it doing when you are bowing down to the deity? What are you also then acknowledging? They are your Lord, Master, and yep, you have a responsibility to serve them. Okay, so that would be the idea of genuine worship. And that should be our heart's inclination, even if we're not physically putting our knees down onto the ground. The same thing occurs in 1 Corinthians 14:25. And thus the secrets of his heart are revealed. And so falling down on his face, he will worship God and report that God is truly among you. So this is like the heathen. So anyway, Block has a quote in For the Glory of God. I'm going to read that. Although English translations commonly render both verbs, he's talking about the Hebrew word chava, to worship, and then the Greek word proskuneo, to worship. So English translations commonly render both verbs as worship. Most people have no clue what these words communicate in the Bible. Both literally refer to subjects prostrated before a superior, a posture that states the equivalent of long live the king. Okay, so that's the heart of worship, would be I am the servant, you are the Lord. And then what does that then result in? Okay, service, like action, like you are the king. I'm going to obey you, even if my feelings don't want to.
Amen.
All right. Yeah, I have this little quote here anyway. I'm going to read this. This is another quote from Block on page 17. He writes, for the moment, we observe only that the dominant physical gesture of worship in the scriptures is prostration. Our contemporary squabbles over worship rarely, if ever, include discussions of physically bending the knee before God, which may be a measure of how uninterested people are in truly biblical worship. Ooh. Surely worship that pleases God involves bodily gestures of subordination and submission. So now in that last statement, I'm going to read it again. What is Block articulating? Surely worship that pleases God involves bodily gestures of subordination and submission. What is he telling people to do?
To bow or kneel.
To bow down and kneel. Okay. And that's something that we should
point
take
to
seriously.
The Catholics.
Yeah, precisely. Okay, they do it.
Yeah.
All right. Here's the funny thing, though, because then he goes through this whole study of Deuteronomy, and he says Deuteronomy is like the epitome of what it means to worship God. And guess how often the word bow down is used in reference to God in Deuteronomy? One time. Okay, so if the physical gesture of worship is really that important, I would say that I think that we need to have, I don't know, you'd expect a little bit more of it. So that's why I think he's overstating a little bit. And if I push back with him, if he was like in front of me, he's like, yeah, okay. It's probably not that point. But it is kind of interesting that we as Christians don't ever prostrate ourselves in worship.
It's only when we bow our head to pray. Like, that's the only thing time yes. I can think of. Like, we regularly, right. like, let's bow our heads. That, right. That's the only time.
Right.
But at least, especially in the generic evangelical or more progressive worship, air quotes around that,
uh-huh.
singing time.
Yes.
It's not that.
It's not that. It's like the raising of the hands.
Yeah.
Thing.
It's, and you're like looking up looking and leaning up
right,
and,
right.
yeah. You're on the roller coaster getting ready to go down the first hill.
Oh, boy. Okay, so Deuteronomy chapter 10. What? Oh, you had something?
Well, I don't want to derail the conversation.
No, go.
So I'm thinking. So
I just said roller coaster and you said derail. I got really scared.
Thinking about worship, bowing down. What about the word exalt?
Yeah.
I want to exalt God. There are several psalms that talk about exalting God.
Yes.
And does that relate to a different physical posture, just something I'm thinking about?
Yeah, no, that's really good. I'm glad you brought it up. And feel free to throw whatever out here. Okay, so what is the exalting doing? What is that play? What is that? What is God's relationship to the worshiper when you're using words like exalt?
You're making him bigger.
He's
you're making
bigger.
Him,
he's higher.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he's above. So he's above.
He's above. Okay, so then what does that then assume about the worshiper? The worshiper is
below. Lower.
Is lower. So there's like this exaltation of God and then this abasement of the worshiper. And that's the language that we see repeatedly. And so you would praise, you would worship the Lord and exalt him and then abase yourself. And so I think that it still would be that. Now, there are some, you know, praise Jesus, you know, raise the hands types of things in the Psalms, and that's where everybody always goes to. But what I'm trying to do is I'm reframing the conversation, because if we're talking about worship, what physical gesture should we be talking about? We should be talking about our knees, not our hands. That's what I want us to see. Okay, so coming into then Deuteronomy 10, verses 12 through 13, I do want to just touch on this very briefly. And now, Israel, what does the Lord your God require of you? Okay, what does God require of you? Oh, to praise Jesus, to worship him. No, it's but to fear the Lord your God, to walk in all his ways, to love him, to serve the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your soul, to keep the commandments of the Lord and his statutes, which I command you today for your good. What is it that God really wants? That's what God really wants, okay? All of the worship and all of the other stuff, what God really wants needs to be framed around, I would say, Deuteronomy 10, 12 through 13. So when we're talking about physical gestures, they should reflect this type of heart. I need to spend more time on that, but I need to move into more of the raising hands stuff, because we need to keep going. Okay, so I'm gonna go to hands, and what do hands symbolize? So what are hands? What do they symbolize in the Bible? Let's get a little interaction here. Talk to me. What do you think about hands in the Bible?
So my first thought wasn't hands, but like the arm of the Lord.
Yeah. Okay. The arm
like
of the Lord.
Strength,
talk about
like
that
his
one.
His mighty
That's
hand.
It. Okay. So you have the hand as a metonymy for the things that are being done.
Put your hand to the plow.
Put your hand to the plow, mm-hmm. like get to work. All right. And so that's the idea of a hand. A hand is a symbol of power, because the hand is the thing by which we do things. Similarly, as an anthropomorphism, which is a big fancy word for ascribing a human attribute to God, okay, God has a hand, metaphorically. And when it speaks about the hand of the Lord, what is it referring to?
What God does.
What God does. All right. So the things that we do, the things that the wicked might do, the hands of the wicked, and then the hand of the Lord. What realm are we talking about here?
Actions.
Actions. Okay, the things that we're doing. Okay, so if we're going to pray to God, I'm going to move into prayer because that's where we see actually a closer connection to hands. Okay, so when we pray to God, hands and heart become important. For example, in Psalm 15, can I get a couple of you, one of you to look up Psalm 15 and the other one to look up Psalm 24? You got Psalm 24?
Yep.
Josh, do you have Psalm 15? Can you do that one? We'll have you do Psalm 15. And note the reference to hands is not as clear in actually Psalm 15. It's really more in Psalm 24. Actually, let's just do Psalm 24. Do you have it there? Or whoever's got it, verses like 3 and 4 or someplace in there.
Okay, Psalm 24. The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and the world and those who dwell therein. For he has founded it upon the seas and established upon the rivers. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord? And who shall stand in his holy place?
Okay, I want to stop you there. What were those questions?
Rhetorical?
Okay, good.
Or
read them again.
Oh, what were they? Okay. Who shall ascend the hill of the Lord?
Okay, so what is at the hill of the Lord?
The Lord.
The Lord is
there. He's up there. Like so that, he's on the hill.
You want to get close to God.
Yep. Who can walk up the hill to be near God?
You want to walk up the hill and be close to God, then what do you need to do?
Well, and the next one says, and who shall stand in his holy place? So it's just like seconding that idea.
Precisely.
Okay. So then verse 4 says, he who has clean hands and a pure heart.
Okay, good.
Who does not lift up his soul to what is false and who does not swear deceitfully.
Okay, so what is clean hands and a pure heart?
Well, your heart is the center of you.
Yep.
It's what you love. It's what you think. It's what you decide. It's your will.
Uh-huh.
And so if your will is toward the Lord and not toward yourself, and then your hands, if it's what you do, clean hands would be clean actions. So if you've been doing sinful actions, you can't ascend the holy hill of the Lord.
Okay. I thought it was that we should all go to the lavatory before we walk into the worship service. You know, we need to clean our hands off. Okay. Obviously, that's not the idea here. And that illustrates, you know, there's like a cleansing component. Can anybody just come and worship the Lord? The answer is no. You need to have clean hands and a pure heart. This is a liturgy at the gate psalm. And that's what we have in Psalm 24. It's also what we have in Psalm 15. Can you read like the first couple of verses of Psalm 15? It's a similar type of thing. If you want to be close to God, if you want to entreat the Lord, how do you do that? What needs to be your condition?
Yeah.
And what would be the answer to that question?
Holy.
You need to be holy. That's fine. Don't even bother. It uses the same terminology about who can draw close to the Lord. So Psalm 15 and 24 are very formative when it comes to drawing close to God, whether that's in worship or in, I would contend, prayer. All right. I'm going to blast through a few passages really quickly. How are we doing? Are we okay? Any questions?
No, we're good. I think I'm following. Yeah.
Are we going to read Psalm 15?
No, I think we'll
just skip it. We've called for it a couple of times.
The listener can go in. Go ahead and read like the first verse or first couple of verses.
All right. Psalm 15. Uh-huh. O Lord, who shall sojourn in your tent? Who shall dwell on your holy hill?
Okay. So see how it's who can get close to God?
He who walks blamelessly and does what is right and speaks truth in his heart, who does not slander with his tongue and does no evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend.
So the hands don't appear in Psalm 15, but the doing evil against his neighbor is referring to the actions which an individual does. So the hands are part of, and clean hands are part of, drawing close to God. Okay, so what I then did is like, okay, what do we see hands doing in the Psalms? Because that's where a lot of this conversation goes to. And what you see is God's hand. The hands that you see repeatedly are the Lord's hands. In Psalm 8, it's the Lord's hands that create the world. In Psalm 10, Verse one states, why do you stand afar off, O Lord? Why do you hide in times of trouble? And then in verse 10, the psalmist asks, arise, O Lord, O God, lift up your hand. Do not forget the humble. In verse 14, but you have seen, you observe trouble and grief to repay it by your hand. Okay, so what is the idea of the hand repeatedly in the Psalter? It's like this type of a thing. And what is that idea? An entreaty of the Lord's hand.
It's his actions on behalf of his people.
Precisely.
Like David is asking him to act. Right. Do something for us humble people who need your help.
Exactly. We need your help because guess what the wicked have done? All right. So in verse 15, break the arm of the wicked and the evil man, because the wicked individuals using their hand to oppress the just. And so what can the just do? Nothing, because the wicked have power. So what do they then, to whom do they then appeal to? The Lord. And they ask the Lord for him to step in and use his hand to vindicate them, to deliver them. Okay, so it's in Psalm 18. It's like a very significant component in Psalm 18. But if you're going to entreat the Lord to bring his hand into the conversation, what do your hands need to be? Clean. Okay, and that's the language that we see repeatedly throughout the entire Old Testament. It's in Isaiah, and Isaiah 1 was a big text for me, where they're raising their hands in prayer to God, saying, God, help us, and God saying, your hands are covered with blood, like your hands are dirty. Okay, you're not really trusting me. You're trying to manipulate and do things on your own. Stop trying to manipulate the circumstances or to affect justice in your way or whatever. Okay, if you're truly going to appeal to me for my hand to get involved, then what do you need to do? You need to have clean hands. And that's the language that we see in Psalm 24, but also in Psalm 18. In Psalm 18, verse 20, the Lord rewarded me according to my righteousness, according to the cleanness of my hands. In verse 24, according to the cleanness of my hands in his sight. So we have these clean hands in Psalm 18. All right, there are some other references. The first reference to lifting up hands comes in Psalm 28. So I want to go to that one now. Psalm 28, it states, to you I will cry, O Lord, my rock, do not be silent, lest if you are silent to me, I become like those who go down to the pit. Okay, what is the psalmist concerned about? He's helpless. He can't do anything. So then what does he do? He appeals to the Lord. Okay, and now Psalm 28, verse 2. Charlie, can you read verse 2?
Hear the voice of my supplications when I cry to you, when I lift up my hands toward your holy sanctuary.
Okay, what is a supplication?
Request.
Yeah, it's a request. So they're making, the psalmist is making a request to God. And what is the posture or the physical gesture associated with that request?
Lifting hands, crying.
Yeah. I cry out to you. It's probably not crying like I'm weeping.
Yes.
It could be. It's like more of like declare. The petition and the declare. And so the lifting up your hands is basically the gesture, physical gesture of what? Why would the person lift up their hands in prayer?
It's a sign of helplessness.
It's a sign of helplessness. It's like, God, I can't do anything.
Because your hands are what you do things with.
Yes.
Oh.
And so then what are you entreating God to do?
Something.
Bring his hand into the situation. This is what you see repeatedly throughout the Psalms, throughout Isaiah. You know, the lifting up of the hands is associated with
prayer.
Prayer. Okay. Now, what do you have in the Psalms? Repeatedly, prayers. So then what do we see in the Psalms? Lifting up of hands. Okay. So that's kind of the physical gesture. So when we started this whole thing, what was the physical gesture of worship that we began with?
Bowing.
Bowing. The body part that would be associated with that would be the knees. Okay. When we're talking about the physical gesture associated with praying, what body part should we be thinking of? Hands. That's what we're talking about when it comes to hands. Okay, how are we?
Pretty good.
So you can work through the psalm. You can do the study yourself. Golden Gay has a quote in his Old Testament theology. He writes, "Reaching out one's hand is a common gesture of appeal. Here the psalm indicates that the hand has been kept out, and has not given in to tiredness." He's referring to Psalm 77, verse 2, which is another one where he stretches out his hand. He's like, I'm keep doing this. My hand is out, and I'm entreating of the Lord to answer me and appeal for me. So that's in his Old Testament Theology, volume 3, page 206. Psalm 60. So now I'm going to go to two texts that are probably the most debated. All right. So Psalm 63 and Psalm 134, something like that. We'll get to it. So Psalm 63 is actually a really well-known psalm. It's referenced in the New Testament, refers to Jesus. Okay, so verse 1 reads, "O God, you are my God. Early will I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My flesh longs for you in a dry and thirsty land where there is no water. So I have looked for you in the sanctuary to see your power and your glory, because your loving kindness is better than life. My lips will praise you. Thus I will bless you while I live. I will lift up my hands in your name." So there's our lifting up the hands. "I will lift up my hands in your name. My soul will be satisfied as with marrow and fatness, and my mouth shall praise you with joyful lips." Okay, so now we have the raising of the hands in praise, presumably. But how does Psalm 63 begin? What's going on?
Well, he's in huge need. He's in a dry land. His soul is thirsting for him. He's seeking after him. So he's looking for God.
Exactly. All right. So there's a huge need. What about verse 7? Stearns, can you read verse 7?
"Because you have been my help, therefore in the shadow of your wings, I will rejoice."
So this joy comes because of the Lord's deliverance and what the Lord's hand has done. So it's still not devoid of this idea of lifting up the hands. Yeah, Carter, you want to read verse 8?
"My soul follows close behind you. Your right hand upholds me."
Oh, isn't that interesting? It's almost like, God, your hand, I raised my hands in prayer because I couldn't do anything. Your hand stepped in and delivered me.
Hmm.
And it's the same idea. So Tate, in his commentary, he writes, "Worship has made the speaker aware of the surpassing value of Yahweh's loyal love, which is better than life itself. A vow of lifelong praise follows in verse 5. The lifted up hands refer to a posture of prayer, probably denoting that the empty hands wait in trust to be filled with the blessings of God, the deliverance." And so this gets into, what does it mean to bless?
Well, bless means to praise.
I
remember being surprised the first time I learned that I should bless the Lord, because I always think of blessings, yes, God gives us. But the other common usage is to praise.
Right.
And you do that when you're praying.
Yes.
Okay. That's why when you read 63:4, I thought, that sounds like praying.
It is. And that's the point. Huh. And it's still part of the prayer idea. So then our last text is Psalm 134. Psalm 134 is three verses. That's all you get is three verses. "Behold, bless the Lord, all you servants of the Lord, who by night stand in the house of the Lord. Lift up your hands in the sanctuary and bless the Lord. The Lord who made heaven and earth, bless you from Zion." That's it. That's the whole psalm. It's only three verses. So this is probably one of the more difficult ones, but this gets into a theology of blessing. Did you have something?
I'll let you go. I have immediate thought about this, but why don't you go?
I would contend I need to, we talked like a year ago about how we need to study blessing more. And I still say I need to study this some more. But you do see within the Pentateuch this blessing that an individual would do. And there was a physical gesture associated with blessing someone. Guess what it was? You raise the hand. Okay, but what would be the idea of raising the hand and blessing? So Leviticus chapter 9, verses 22 through 24, then Aaron lifted his hand toward the people, blessed them, and came down from offering the sin offering, the burnt offering, and peace offerings. Okay, so what would be the purpose of blessing an individual? Like the priest is blessing somebody in a raising of hand. It's like entreating the deity, the Lord, okay, to give something good to the individual. Does that make sense?
Wow.
Okay, so this whole idea of blessing and even the raising of the hand in blessing is like, I'm giving you something good.
Wow.
And so I think you have that same idea in Psalm 134. But even in Psalm 134, how does verse 3 end? The Lord who made heaven and earth.
Bless you.
Bless you. Oh. It's like you're lifting up your hands and blessing the Lord for the good things that he's done. Then you acknowledge he's the creator of heaven and earth. And then what are you expecting for him to give you? Blessing.
Hmm.
So this is probably the one text, all right, that would be the strongest case that is something similar to what people are often doing in the worship services. And what I'm seeing is you've basically got one passage and a lot of other stuff, all right, that's not. Okay, does that make sense? And this one text still doesn't seem to be what's going on with most people when they're raising their hands in worship. Okay, questions?
I would just say that when you read Psalm 134, especially couched in all of the background of what you just brought to us, I had no thought that it was like the hoo-wah-wah, put my hands up when I'm singing.
Yeah.
And the other thought is that what's the sanctuary right here?
Uh-huh.
What is it?
Right.
Is it the temple?
Yeah, it would be the temple. Go ahead.
So then in the New Testament, what does Jesus condemn the money people, money changers, mm-hmm. and whatnot? It says my father's house should be a house of what? A house of prayer. And so I'm immediately, when you read this, I thought, oh yeah, you go to the sanctuary to pray.
Yep.
And so that made perfect sense. So I think if you're in the Jewish worldview,
yes.
that's how you would take that. Mm-hmm. The only way I think you would take it differently is if you came to the text with that assumption already, right. and then you read it right into it.
Yes. No, that's really a good observation. In Psalm 134, who is doing the blessing? Lift up your hands in the sanctuary and bless the Lord. Who's doing that? Verse 1, all you servants of the Lord. And so the question is, who are the servants of the Lord? Is it the worshipers? It could be, but it's more likely the priests. And so what are they doing? They are blessing the Lord, and then in blessing the Lord, expecting the Lord to bless the people, it's Leviticus 9, okay? It's Numbers chapter 6 with the Aaronic blessing. It's that same idea of praising God, or not praising, but blessing God. What I do find interesting is that you don't ever see halal. Halal is your word for praise. And you don't see hands. I could be wrong. I didn't do an extensive. If there is a passage, then somebody let me know. But what I see instead is something like Psalm 141, verse 2. Let my prayer be set before you as incense, the lifting up of my hands as the evening sacrifice. And so have we lost something? I think we have. I think we've lost something because we've associated the raising of hands with feeling a specific way. Instead, what should we associate the raising of hands? Well, this is something I began studying like a couple of years ago, maybe. I can't remember when it was. How often do I raise my hands in prayer? And then what does Timothy state in, remember your Grok gave us Psalm 63, which we talked about, and 1 Timothy 2. And what are the men supposed to do? Lift up holy hands, clean hands, okay? Holy hands, entreating the God mm-hmm. of the universe, the maker of heaven and earth, to intervene and to help. And I would contend that's something that we need to recapture. Yes, raise your hands. Raise your hands in prayer. May your hands be clean. May they be holy. And then entreat the God who has all power, the creator of heaven and earth, to effect justice in the land, to deliver you from whatever the situation or circumstance might be. Sure, you can do that. Are there wicked out there? Are they using their hand against you? Yes. Entreat the God of heaven and earth that he would use his hand. And I would encourage you, there is something sweet and beautiful about getting down on your knees and even raising your hands in prayer and asking the God of the universe to do something that only he can do. I recently did this with a father, and he was entreating the God of the universe to work in the heart of his son. Who can do that? God can. So lift up your hands and plead with him to deliver you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Thinklings Podcast. We would love to hear from you. If you have any feedback, suggestions, or potential topics that you'd like us to discuss, you can contact us through our email, thinklingspodcast@gmail.com. Remember, don't let this conversation end with this podcast. Read good books, talk about them with your friends, and always continue to cultivate your mind. See you next time on the Thinklings Podcast.